I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Curzon Film Podcast. This week, going from the midst of war in Israel to post-war Berlin, we take a look at Samuel Maoz's award-winning festival hit Foxtrot, and the Keira Knightley starring period drama, The Aftermath, as well as looking at some of our favourite foreign language war films. I'm Sam Howlett, and the poor souls joining me down in the pod bunker this week are Kelly Powell.
Hello.
Ella Kemp.
Hi.
And Stephen Ryder.
Hello.
Hello. So starting with Foxtrot then, this is Samuel Maoz's follow-up to the award-winning Lebanon, grappling with the complexities of the Israel-Palestine conflict in this masterful balance of heightened drama and absurdist humour. An Israeli family, the Feldmans, are informed that their son has been killed whilst on duty. They are devastated, but then not everything is as it appears. From a searing and emotive opening through to a series of surreal moments at the front line of a political quagmire, Maoz's film is quite unlike anything you'll have ever seen. So Maoz won the Golden Lion a few years back at the Venice Film Festival for Lebanon, which is another war film, but it's set entirely in a tank. So from Lebanon now to Foxtrot, we can see that Maoz is interested in looking at war from a unique perspective. Both Lebanon and Foxtrot have their characters' views limited by their surroundings. But while Lebanon's view of war is completely limited and very realistic, Foxtrot has a more creative approach to the view of war and plays around with the form to explore war, but the characters are just as unable to see the full picture. And something I think very unique to this film is its structure. Kelly, do you want to tell us about Foxtrot's unique structure and what makes it so different?
I read a review where it was sort of described as a triptych, which I thought was quite a nice way of describing this film, because it's three-act structure. It doesn't follow a traditional three-act structure, where it sort of takes the first act is from the father's perspective, after the family is told that their son has died in the line of duty. And then that is like a very intimate portrayal of his grief in those moments. Conflicted with the sort of systemic way that the IDF sort of treats someone who's fallen. So there's the Israeli Defense Force, sorry. So it's sort of like they have procedures that they follow. And the soldiers that are there to inform the family, you know, have like a sort of a script that they follow. So it's like, is there anything we can do for you? You need to drink water. There's this like weird repetition of the soldier saying like, you need to drink water to the father who's obviously in shock.
And there's an hourly alarm on his
phone. Yeah, they set an alarm on his phone. Yeah, very like clockwork for the IDF. And
yeah, like there's a way to deal with grief that, that is simple and, you know, structured.
Yeah,
that's the way you do it.
And it's the father sort of reeling against that and sort of like trying to find his own way through that. And then the second act sort of, which is the bulk, I think, of the film, sort of takes place at a checkpoint Foxtrot where the son is stationed. And we see his last few days at the, because I think they move on after that. So it's his sort of last few days at the checkpoint. And this act sort of follows a quite a surrealistic, weirdly comical tone. The tone changes in every single act of this film. But yeah, it's from the son's perspective, and it's him and three other soldiers at this checkpoint that is sort of desolate in the middle of nowhere. Apart from a few camels and like one or two cars of Palestinians having to be checked at the checkpoint, nothing much happens. And it's sort of their weird... It's almost like you see them as individuals in this sort of weird structure, the system, because it's the only point at which we sort of know the soldiers. And there's like a couple of shots where you see them on their beds in this bunker, and they're quite individualized. Like the one guy's like a punk rocker, and you see his personality, and you kind of get to know these soldiers' personalities.
Well, it's interesting that Sam used the word perspective in terms of, you know, we are getting, like you said, we're getting the individual and the system and those two things being pushed together. But the perspective of the film and the position of the camera is also wildly different than what you'd see in most kind of war films. That overhead shot that he keeps coming back to, I was thinking, I loved it at first, and I thought, wow, this is, you know, he's overusing this a little bit. And then it became almost comical in its overuse that we were seeing only overhead shots of people. And you start thinking, why? Why is the director doing this?
It's like a weird distancing technique as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which I think was a slight concern for me in this film, because I think, like, just at the point where you're sort of getting to know these people, the camera movements sort of pull you out of it. And I think it's a play on, like, I think empathy and the system, maybe just like how the minute you sort of get to know an individual, it explores how they exist within that structure.
Mm. Well, there is always this very strange sense of humour that I found came across from the very first images you'd see from this film from the outside, like the promotional things. They use a very specific clip from this film where there's a soldier who doesn't actually have any other role in the film. He is this dancer who was cast just to do this big movement piece, who does this amazing dance at the checkpoint. And it's not different at all to the way it seems. And it doesn't really have any narrative significance as such. Like, it's not a film about how much these soldiers love to dance or anything like that. But there is this motif that obviously comes back in the name of the film. And just in... it's got such a deeper metaphorical, serious meaning. And yet comes across in such a lighthearted and kind of strange... comical way as well.
It's a tone switch, I think, that scene is, that you get, if I remember, it goes from just a few scenes before you see the father, who's played by Leo Ashkenazi, who is I think stunning in this film. There's one particular moment just a few scenes before the dance scene, which is incredible, where he's sat in the bathroom, and you go from one of those overhead shots to a very kind of intimate close-up of him. And it's a good minute, maybe even a minute and a half, of just his eyes kind of darting back and forth and him trying to figure out what to do with the knowledge that his son has been killed. And you aren't taken away from this scene at any point. You have to watch him try and figure it out, and he cannot do it. And it's a stunning, stunning performance, I think, from him. And he carries the first 30 minutes of this film in a way that, like, do we really want to sit here and watch, like, this father kind of grieve his son for this long? But the film forces you to do that. And then all of a sudden we're switched into this dance scene, and it just kind of pops. You see the camel coming through the checkpoint, and then you see the dance scene, and it's it's this sudden change of tone, and you really don't know what to do with it. But it certainly kind of wakes you up from that kind of slumber and that kind of wallowing in the grief.
I think as well, this film doesn't rely on sort of typical war imagery too much, and you know, you've spoken about a couple of things here and there that the camera angles are so unique in this film, and to the point where they're kind of pulling you out of it, as you said. And that's something really interesting to do with the war film. And also, this film relies a lot on visual metaphor. So you mentioned the dance there, which is kind of the lead image of the film. Do you want to talk a bit about what you think the dance means, that the dance has this such a prominent scene in the film and is even spoken about a few times, about what the foxtrot dance is and what that means to the characters?
So there's a point at the end of the film when it kind of... so it comes back to the third act, which again has such a different tone to the first two. And
it's from the mother's perspective.
Right.
Yeah.
And so the mother, she's sitting at the kitchen table, and she is having a conversation with her husband. And then he gets up and starts to talk about the foxtrot dance again, which by this point in the film, we've been introduced to it from a lot of different angles, but I think the script is so tight that it still seems fresh. And then when he starts to just get up and move and explain it, I still found it really satisfying. And while he's dancing, the father says, no matter where you go, you end up at the same starting point, as he's moving round and round. And I love it, because I think that's one of the only lines in the script that I remember being really metaphorical and kind of seeming to be the kind of thing that you take notes of, like I just did, to then explain it afterwards. Yeah. But yeah, and that whole idea of a cycle just reflects like the narrative, the dance, their lives, grief, war, like all of it.
Yeah, and it's allegorical, right? So the whole thing, it kind of does sort of follow like a parable sort of structure, interwoven into like other themes that's, you know, are prevalent in Israeli society. I mean, this is a society that has been at war since its inception. and these men and women are, you know, there's, what do you call it? The conscription. There's like, they're drafted into the army straight after school, and you have to go. And so every person in Israeli society has been in the IDF, and then, and many of them do see war. And there's this weird undertone of like everybody's traumatized. This is like a traumatized society in a way. And in a society like that, you can't really move on. It's kind of is cyclical. Like, you know, it's kind of you're trapped in this weird circle of like, and in that, it's like it's difficult for empathy to flourish, for artistic merit to flourish, for masculinity to develop healthily. So I think there's a lot of that sort of interwoven into the plot and the narrative of this film.
One final thing I wanted to say about the cyclical element of the film, the soundtrack which is used, and the main song in particular, is a song called Spiegel in Spiegel, which is used in so many different films and adverts and everything, and it's got this really recognisable hook. And I think often when it comes back in other films, I find myself thinking, okay, this song is here again. This means it's sad. This is like the moment where everyone cries. But I think it's such a bold move that this film uses this song again and again and again. It's, the song is a loop in itself, but it's used as a recurring theme, like some kind of motif, as if it was written for the film, which, you know, people do more and more, like, you know, Justin Hurwitz says it all the time, it sounds great. But to use something that's already so recognisable and yet to put it into this context in this way, I think it worked so well.
I will say that, like, there's it's a very sophisticated film, and there's a lot of layered kind of elements to it, but even though it sounds like what we're talking about, we're kind of digging through this stuff, I think it's actually a really easy film to watch in a lot of ways too. It draws you in, and it does this balancing act of having this very intense kind of dour situation, yet somehow making it accessible and entertaining. And that is, as an audience member, you're kind of left wondering how to feel about the whole situation. Because when these moments of comedy do pop up, and when these moments of pure entertainment do pop up, it does take you aback. And I think that's one of the real strengths that Foxtrot's got going for it.
I think ultimately, I think that there are many like entry points into this film. And so I think that there's something for everyone to get out of it, however you see it. And I think that it's just a very unique take on this theme, and especially in Israeli film, dealing, you know, coming from the region. I think it's unique, and it's interesting, and he uses camera angles in weird ways, and I think it's, as Stephen said, you know, simultaneously dealing with like heavy topic matter, but it is also light.
It's a balancing act.
It's a balancing act. Yeah. So I think definitely worth a watch.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
So that's Foxtrot then, that is out this Friday, March the 1st, exclusively in cinemas and on Curzon Home Cinema. War films then never seem to go out of fashion, but foreign language war films are less jingoistic and more difficult than their UK and US counterparts. So we asked Twitter what are some of the best foreign language war films they could think of. At Tony Elliston brought up Istian Szabo's Mephisto, Louis Malle's Au Revoir Les Enfants, Vittoria De Sica's The Garden of the Finzi Continis, The Battle of Algiers, Shoah, and Come and See, which he says is probably the best of the lot.
It's a stunning one.
At Evil Donald 13 has suggested 20 Days Without War, Grave of the Fireflies, and The Front Line. And formerly of the Curzon podcast, Irena Musumeci on Twitter has suggested that the Russians do it better. Come and See and Ivan's Childhood. Stephen, that's one of your picks, isn't it?
Yeah.
Plus Bondarchuk's War and Peace, of course.
Yeah, I think that the idea that the Russians do it better is kind of morbid in a way, because obviously they went through a very specific kind of trauma in the war. They lost more people than anybody else in World War II. But what I think the Russians do is they portray an elegant side of war that draws you in before reminding you of the horrors of it. And I think the reason I picked Ivan's Childhood is because I know a lot of kind of, you know, this was my case when I was young, as a kind of someone who was getting interested in film. Tarkovsky became a bit of a mountain to climb. You've got these kind of 3-hour epics of Stalker and Solaris that are very kind of esoteric and difficult to figure out. But anyone looking for an entry point into Tarkovsky's career could sit down and watch Ivan's Childhood and love it. It's an accessible film. It still deals with all those kind of classic Tarkovsky topics of memory and dreams and kind of figuring out where you stand on the planet Earth and in civilization, but it's a very simple tale of a young boy kind of navigating his way through war, both mentally and kind of both figuratively and physically. So it's a fascinating, incredible, beautiful film. It's well worth a watch.
That came up a few times on Twitter, as did Come and See. Downfall, starring the late Bruno Ganz, that came up a few times. Son of Saul, Das Boot, No Man's Land, and What's with Bashir?
Mm.
Kelly.
Yeah, so I love this film. And like much like Foxtrot, it is a very unique film from the region, dealing with the Lebanon War. Mm-hmm. It's a very unique take coming from the experiences of director Ari Folman, who narrates his story, which is a story of also trauma, and his sort of memory loss of his time as a soldier in Lebanon, and it's just exquisitely done. I think when I first saw it, I was just like, whoa, this, I've never seen the documentary take this form before. And the animation was so like vivid.
It's a living comic book, really.
It's a moving graphic novel, which was just so moving and interesting, and I just remember being enamored with it.
I think it's a spectacular film. And like Foxtrot, it's playing around with the form.
Yeah, exactly.
Because, you know, as I said, UK and US war films, we tend to kind of know what we're going to get from them. Can be very paint by numbers. But with stuff like Foxtrot and Wars for Bashir, we're getting, you know, filmmaking techniques in different ways to explore things that we think we know.
The fact that war is a genre of itself tells you how important that the topic of war is to society. And I think it's so important, as you know, cinema viewers, that we get to experience different viewpoints of war, because if we look at it from just a UK US perspective, then we're getting almost a propagandist view of how we've perceived war in the past, and you know, history is written by the victors and all of that kind of stuff. So
yeah,
And to go on the other side of all of the oceans, the film that I'm going for is The Wind Rises, which is Hayao Miyazaki's most recent film. I tend to find with war films that I feel a bit isolated when watching them, and I don't really... It's not my favourite genre, but I really like this film because it takes a very human approach. And I was wondering if it could class as a war film. So it focuses in on a young engineer called Jiro Horikoshi, who is based on a real person, who was one of the engineers who made the Zero fighter plane, which Japan used in the Second World War. And I love this film. It's my favourite Miyazaki film because I think it's a lot more grounded and a lot more human than his other films. There are still lots of magical elements and lots of dreams to it, but it is fueled by this historical grounding. But what I find really interesting about the film is more the kind of context around it and the way that Miyazaki kind of mirrors Jiro and the backlash and controversy that surrounded the film when it came out, because lots of critics, not necessarily film critics, but just critics of Miyazaki in Japan and elsewhere, were calling him like a traitor and just saying that it was insane that he was making this film, like that he was condoning the war and things like that. And he was saying, they were saying that how could he do this to endorse Japan's past, which is insane when you consider how much of a pacifist Miyazaki has always been, and he's been so very vocally.
Is this relationship that I think governments have with the films that are made about
this
war?
One, Foxtrot also.
Yeah,
Backlash.
It's something that you see a lot in foreign language war films, is that you see so much criticism. Tarkovsky was criticised for Ivan's childhood too. I remember there was controversy about Folman's experiences in the war as well and how much they could be considered legitimate.
Yeah.
And I think the same goes for Wind Rises too. So when a director makes a war film, although it's a topic that we like to explore a lot, there's always controversy surrounding it.
But I find it quite interesting with the case of Jiro and Miyazaki, because Miyazaki always quotes back this same quote that Jiro said, and he says in the film about the Zero, he says, "All I wanted to do was make something beautiful," which I love. And then that's why I wondered whether it was about war, because he puts a focus on this young man who just has this dream of making something beautiful and, you know, seeing an airplane fly in the sky. And then he also says that the Zero represented one of the few things that we Japanese could be proud of. So I really love that kind of conflict that there's in that film that reflects the nation who kind of coming to terms with their past and responsibility in the war, and Miyazaki as well as his responsibility as an auteur who passed his influence within war films. He's always said that children should go outside and not watch films. He says, like, at the helm of the biggest studio in Japan.
I think what these war films do better than US and UK war films is that the fighting is very much in the background.
Yeah.
None of the films we've suggested really have sensationalized fighting scenes as their big centerpieces.
But also, I think
Hacksaw Ridge.
Exactly, I'm talking about Hacksaw Ridge.
But
yeah,
also I think
which kind of has it's about a character, it's about a pacifist, it's a character study, but the fighting is the main character in that film.
Loud.
That film's all about how well you can make a shootout.
Yeah, exactly.
But what I was going to say about foreign films is that I think they do such a good job of exploring war as like how it affects life afterwards. So like I was gonna say a few more honorable mentions.
Wait,
for me.
Are you talking about The Aftermath?
Wait.
Oh my God.
Just told
that's
you.
Coming.
Hold
that's
that.
Coming. Was Hiroshima Mon Amour, also like an incredible film that explores war in a very different way. Another one that is more in the Cold War era is The Lives of Others. And just like how war sort of affects people.
And our very own Cold War as well, that we spoke about a few months ago.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Coldest of wars.
The coldest of wars, the warmest of hearts. Correct. The film that came to mind for me is a film called Germany Year Zero, which is an early Italian neorealism film by Roberto Rossellini, father of Isabella. It's about a family in Berlin just after the end of World War II who struggle to adjust to the post-war environment, and there's all these tensions between, you know, the newly occupying allies and the former soldiers, whether they were just people on the ground or whether they were high-ranking Nazis. But what the film's mostly interested in, obviously it's a neorealist film, it's interested in the ordinary people who are affected by all of this and who don't get their own story in war films. And this film came up very close to the end of World War II, so it was quite close to the bone. And, you know, it's Italian neorealism, so it's pretty downbeat, but I think it's a really interesting look at this part of history, which leads nicely to our next new release this week, which is also set in post-war Berlin, and that is James Kent's The Aftermath. Ella, tell us about The Aftermath.
I would love to. So, The Aftermath focuses on a young woman called Rachel Morgan, played by Keira Knightley. She arrives in the ruins of Hamburg in the bitter winter to be reunited with her husband, Lewis, who's played by Jason Clarke. So he's a British colonel who's charged with rebuilding the shattered city. But as they both set off together for their new home, Rachel is stunned as she discovered that he has made an unexpected decision. He has decided that they will be sharing the grand house with its previous owners, a German widower, Alexander Skarsgård, and his troubled teenage daughter. In this charged atmosphere, we then have enmity and grief that give way to passion and betrayal.
You've been avoiding me.
Have I? I don't think so.
I was going to apologize.
For what? Don't.
I was going to. But I won't.
Stephen, what do you think of The Aftermath?
The Aftermath's a really interesting film. I was reading that it was written as a screenplay, and then the screenwriter was, it was suggested that he make it into a novel and then adapt that for the screen, which is a really roundabout way to go about making a film. But it definitely shows in this film it's got a very novelistic approach. It's very, like Ella mentioned, I think charged is one of the right words to use. It's got a real kind of sexual energy to it that you don't see in a lot of war films. But there's a really amazing juxtaposition between the bombed out city that we're kind of witnessing Jason Clarke's character try to rebuild the society, and the very elegant, pristine home that they're sharing with Alexander Skarsgård's character. I think The Aftermath is if you saw kind of Colette earlier this year, you know what Keira Knightley's going to bring to a film. You know that kind of like... the elegance and the kind of abundance of imagery that you see in these kind of films and metaphor. It's a very lovely film that kind of people will definitely be drawn to if they're interested in kind of war dramas, especially period war dramas.
I think the nice thing is that if you like on paper the things that this film is offering, you will like them in practice. I think it's 100%. It's definitely reliable, and it's not unpredictable in a way that could be shocking or disturbing, which you can find with war films. I wouldn't say that The Aftermath is particularly traumatic. It's, as you say, it's elegant, and there's this whole, you know, seductive element to it that makes it all it's very luxurious.
It's a very luxurious film.
Like, everyone is very attractive, and their characters are attractive, and they're attracted to each other, and in a way, like, it's a nice distraction from war. War is there.
Well, that's what Keira Knightley's character is trying to do in this film. She's experienced a trauma during the war, and she's trying to kind of pull herself out of it by having an affair with this German man that she's sharing a house with. And it's about, you know, the lengths we go to escape the past and to escape trauma. And that's why we have these two things, the bombed out city and the house, because she's pulled between these two things and her past and her future and her present. And, you know, what I did like about the film is that the ending has a real kind of comment to make on what we should do with our grief. So it's kind of worth seeing, I think, just to see where it goes with that.
And poor, poor, poor Jason Clarke, once again playing a jilted husband.
Yeah, that's his speciality. Though, isn't it? Yeah,
someone's got to do it.
Yeah, it was Mudbound, he kind of was, and Serenity that comes out this week as well.
Mm-hmm. And now this one.
So this film kind of, I don't know, what are the touch points for you guys with this? Like, Atonement seems like a good comparison, this kind of romance against the backdrop of a war.
Yeah, absolutely. I think Atonement's a really good example. Yeah.
Not just because it's Keira Knightley again.
No, not just because it's Keira Knightley, but we all know she's drawn to these kind of films, these kind of films with very, very heightened emotional stakes that she can kind of use and play off. And she's very good at that. It's what Keira does. I think that it goes for a kind of prestige-y atmosphere, and it ends up being in a weird way a bit too dark for that, I think. Maybe a bit too kind of a bit too erotic, a bit too violent, and it ends up kind of going to some dark places in the film. And whilst some people might consider it predictable, I think it's still hard hitting in places as well.
And yeah, I think not necessarily so much in the subject matter, but just in the overall look and style of the film. I don't think it's too far from Carol. Like, the costumes are beautiful. Everyone's hair is very great, and everyone's, you know, very upset a lot of the time, and that's okay. And you've got to deal with that, whether you're within the war or any other setting. So it's a real, real visual treat.
It's a fascinating double bill with Foxtrot, because it is again a film that deals with grief between two parents, and it's a film that has a dance scene in it towards the end that's kind of very critical.
How do the dance scenes compare?
Very different motivations.
Very different, yeah, very different.
This moment is not about movement.
Okay, that is The Aftermath, which is also out today, March the 1st. So you can do a double bill. You can do The Aftermath in cinemas and Foxtrot on Cousin Home Cinema. Also on Cousin Home Cinema, we do have a collection of some of the films that have won Best Foreign Language Film at the Oscars in the past few years. So The Salesman and Son of Saul, which is another unique take on a war film, and some of the films that didn't quite get the awards this year. So a shock for Glenn Close not winning The Wife, but if you want to check out that performance, you can. RBG and Cold War also still available. Thank you to everyone who gave us a shout out on Twitter for those foreign language war films, and if you've got any thoughts on Foxtrot or The Aftermath, do let us know by emailing podcast@curzon.com for next week's show, or tweet us at Curzon Cinemas. You can subscribe, leave a review or a comment. We are available every week on iTunes, Acast, Spotify, or wherever else you get your podcast needs. Next week, Kelly, you're going to be speaking to Maggie Gyllenhaal, who's going to be telling us all about her latest film, The Kindergarten Teacher. Very exciting. Mm-hmm. And we're going to be discussing the latest from the Marvel Cinematic Universe, Captain Marvel. You can follow me at samhowlett_1. You can follow Kelly on Twitter at
KS_Powell.
You can follow Ella at
EFE Kemp.
Stephen, you're still averse to Twitter.
But I got a Letterboxd Pro account, which means...
Did you?
Yeah, which meant I could change my name.
Whoa.
So it's not silly anymore. Now you can just find me at Stephen Ryder with two R's at the end. Is that silly as well?
I mean, why?
Yeah. Just do what I do. My name, my surname, one. Straight down the middle, no messing about.
Just find me on there.
Thank you very much for listening. We'll see you next week.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford Tough, Built Ford Proud.